Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. A court in The Hague is set to rule tomorrow on a dispute between the Philippines and China over islands in the South China Sea. Last week, Beijing said that the U.S. military buildup in the region constituted, quote, a direct threat to its national security, close quote. Despite U.S. assertions of the need for freedom of navigation, does Washington's position actually amount to believing that the Pacific is America's backyard or its lake? And is the United States playing other countries in the region against China for its own benefit? Today, we will spend the full hour looking at how the dispute in the South China Sea affects the region and the world. We are joined from Connecticut by James Bradley. He is the author of the book, The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. And by author Patrick Lawrence. His latest book is Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Good to be here.
Okay, great. James Bradley, let's start with you. Just help our audience. We have a U.S. audience. We have a global audience. Let's start with the court ruling in The Hague tomorrow, July 12th. Will this be a turning point in the South China Sea dispute? Will it settle scores?
No, it won't settle scores, and it'll probably ratchet up tensions and focus more of an aggressive outlook on China and what they need done. I think it's going to be unfortunate, and it might freeze things up much more. The problem here is it's a highly emotional problem. It's a tough nut to crack because on the Chinese side, they're using the word sovereign. We want our sovereign territory. This is sovereign territory. That resonates with the man in the street in China after 100 years of humiliation. On the American side, we're using the word freedom. We love that word here. It resonates. It's freedom of navigation. So, again, a highly emotional issue between the two countries here.
Patrick Lawrence, talk about what the arbitration is specifically. The Philippines brought the arbitration. The Chinese side does not recognize it. It says the court actually has no jurisdiction and that while they will not fight it in the court because it doesn't have jurisdiction, they're not going to accept it either. Talk about what it really is. What are the practical specifics of this?
Well, preceding the Philippines brought a case against the Chinese a couple of years ago, okay, brought it to The Hague and asked for international adjudication under, if I have my legal terms correct, under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. A few problems here. One, prior to bringing that case, the Philippines had actually agreed to negotiate this question of territoriality in the East and South China Sea bilaterally, okay? So you have...
Between the two countries. In other words, between the Philippines and China.
That's right. So you have an immediate question. I find a rather enticing question. Why did the Philippines agree to bilateral talks and then request international adjudication? I think the answer to that lies in the State Department, if you ask me, right? The Philippines, with some exceptional periods, has been a very cooperative client of the United States since the 30s.
So what you're saying actually, Patrick, is that the State Department, the United States, was the agency that put pressure on or convinced or...
Look, you can't traffic in certainty here, Brian, but that's what it looks like to me. Why would they bring an international case when they had already agreed to negotiate? So that's problem one. Problem two is on the legal side. China maintains the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea has no jurisdiction over questions of sovereignty. And at issue here are questions of sovereignty if I understand the issue properly, because there is land involved, okay? Little specks of land. Those are rather important. Now, look, that may sound like a legalism. Indeed, it is, but it's an important one, right? So it's a question of jurisdiction. Finally, the Chinese, James is correct, this judgment Monday is going to worsen matters. I don't really see there's any way around that. I rather regret in some ways the way the Chinese have handled this. They, in a certain way, Xi Jinping has somewhat painted himself into a corner. May have done a better job.
Let me get James Bradley back in. Has Xi Jinping painted himself into a corner?
Yeah, you could say that, and I agree with everything that Patrick just said. I wrote this book called The China Mirage, and the China Mirage is the idea that what America does is going to affect China's behavior. I mean, you're talking about one-fourth of humanity. This is not a third-world country rising. This is China, which has been for most of history the dominant, richest, most sophisticated culture. You got 1.4 billion people, and you know, they're not going to recognize Western legalistic norms in brand new countries like the United States. This is China, and they're looking to secure their borders. And they say that United States movements are a direct threat to their security. That's something that doesn't resonate well with Americans because they're not looking at the true maps. If you look at the New York Times, you can look at brilliant interactive maps about the sandbars, the islands that China's reinforcing, but they never show the larger picture. Back up, show, open the aperture, and look at those U.S. bases surrounding China. So if we think China should tolerate missiles pointed directly at downtown Beijing, then we probably wouldn't mind if they put in a huge Chinese base in Baja California, and they were sucking up all our email intelligence on the West Coast. And then the next step would be a base up in Nova Scotia where they could patrol Washington and New York. We wouldn't stand for it, and the Chinese want to rewrite the rules.
Well,
Brian,
go ahead, Patrick.
May I add to that?
Go ahead.
Look, in a certain way, dilate the lens is exactly the thought James contributed good. You have to step back. I urge your listeners to step back and consider this in quite a lot more historical context than they're going to find in ordinary media, okay? This is, in a certain way, a corrective on China's part. The lines involved here, including the famous nine dash lines, have their origin in Washington's post-war Cold War designs, okay? All the Chinese are doing, and this also obtains in the case of the islands in dispute between China and Japan, further north in the sea, East China Sea. What the Chinese are doing, if you look at this in historical context, is attempting to correct radically aggressive cartography dating to the 1940s, okay? I think that's exceedingly important to understand. I would add one other point. It has to do with something else James noted, and that is the question of militarization in the region. If we're going to get to that later in the show, I'll leave it. But look, between the Korean Peninsula, Japan, Okinawa is more or less a civilian society transformed into a disgraceful garrison. The Philippines, we've now got a marine base in Australia for who knows what practical use. The Western Pacific has been militarized for 70 years, maybe more, okay? When the Americans are complaining about Chinese and the militarization of the region, the vocabulary is carefully chosen to mislead. They're talking about somebody putting up defenses and objections to what has long been America's militarization of this region.
Okay, that was Patrick Lawrence. He's the author of his latest book is Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. We're also joined by James Bradley, the author of the book, The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. James Bradley, coming back to you, Patrick Lawrence is emphasizing the militarization that this maritime dispute, this arbitration that was initiated by the Philippines, but possibly under the demands of or the urging of the U.S. State Department, which at that time, I think it was in 2012, would have been under the leadership of Hillary Clinton. They've taken it all the way. There's a new government in the Philippines, which we should talk about later, may impact the outcome of these kind of discussions. But let's talk about the militarization, because it is a profound part of the context, the big picture for China. If the Asia pivot, which was announced by President Obama in Australia a few years ago, that means that by 2020, I believe 60% of the U.S. Air Force and U.S. naval assets will be in the Pacific region. In other words, something that China will perceive as a threat, a direct threat. And then you also have the THAAD missile defense, presumably as a way to protect against North Korean missiles, but the Chinese see it as an advanced surveillance operation against all things China. Talk about that.
Well, you just said, and what Patrick said, are extremely important points that don't get into the American media very much. Yes, who's being aggressive here? The Gallup poll did an international survey, 64,000 people, 65 countries, and said, what country is the biggest threat to world peace? One quarter, 25% of the international respondents said the United States of America. 4% said China. I mean, the South China Sea crisis is taking part 6,000 miles from our shore, but the Navy needs an enemy, which is China. The Army is ramping up against Russia. Yes, we've militarized the area. And there's, I mean, when I was a kid, it was the domino theory. Oh, my God. If the U.S. military doesn't get involved here, China is going to gobble up all of Southeast Asia. That's what I was told in the 50s and 60s. 4 million people died. Those American offensive operations were launched from the Philippines, Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea, the same arc that we would use against China now. If I was in Beijing, I would have some concerns.
Patrick Lawrence, it's very interesting what James was mentioning. We had the Red China Scare, when I was a child, that's what it was called, the Red Chinese. We also had, of course, the Soviet communist threat. In other words, there was an ideological coloration in the global struggle waged by the United States with these two other major powers. In the case of the Soviet Union, it is no more. Russia is not a socialist government. And the red in China, the Red Chinese, has become considerably more pink or very diluted. In other words, it's not an ideological struggle at this point, and yet the struggle just goes on, and it has this very powerful military component. So was the Cold War something other than an ideological struggle, or was it more complicated, or how do you explain it today?
Look, I spent 3 decades of my professional life in the non-West, most of it in the region we're talking about, and I came away from that with one larger thought. It's explored in the last book but one. Parity between the West and non-West I invite your listeners to consider whether they agree. I consider it an inevitable feature of the 21st century. Okay? What we are living through now is strenuous resistance to all such thinking. All right?
Resistance from whom?
Washington, the Europeans take their normal places, pilot fish or follow-ons. They always surprise me, the Europeans, with their obsequiousness. But primarily Washington, it's about primacy, okay? It's not ideological the way we three speaking here this afternoon had the experience of while we were growing up, sure, right? Parenthetically, you have to remind people that Vladimir Putin is not a communist, right? We're so mixed up on this. But no, it's not ideological in that sense, but it is in another sense. It has to do with America's desire for hegemony. We are simply not going to let go of that military hegemony, and close at hand, the primacy of the neoliberal economic order, one feature of which is it cannot tolerate dissidents. Okay, that's what's going on, right? Along with, I mean, by the way, a marvelous tableau that'll bring it all home to your listeners occurred in April when Defense Secretary Carter stood on the deck of the Stennis, an aircraft carrier, just near the waters we're talking about, and complained about China militarizing the Western Pacific. To me, that I've had it in columns, that just said everything. I mean, this man wants to turn nighttime into day, right?
Yeah, that's Patrick Lawrence. His latest book is Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. We're also talking to James Bradley. He's the author of the book, The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. A court in The Hague is set to rule tomorrow on a dispute between the Philippines and China over islands in the South China Sea. Last week, Beijing said that the U.S. military buildup in the region constituted a direct threat to its national security. Despite U.S. assertions of the need for freedom of navigation, does Washington's position actually amount to believing that the Pacific belongs to the United States? And is the United States playing the Philippines and other countries in the region against China for its own benefit? Patrick Lawrence, I believe we were talking with you when we went to the break. Let me toss it back to James. James Bradley, the Chinese government, no matter what The Hague rules or the arbitration panel in The Hague rules, China's not going to, I mean, it will affect China, but China's not going to recognize it, right?
I would guess not. What's a little new court in new countries, Western law? You know, a lot of as Patrick said, a lot of these lines were drawn when there was no China. Right after World War II, there was a Chinese Civil War. China didn't have a centralized, unified government, and the U.S. military drew lines. By giving an island to Japan, the United States military was basically putting those islands in its back pocket. Japan's an occupied country, American bases up and down. What really concerns me, though, is that what I hear Patrick saying, I think is so truthful, but Americans can't hear language like that in the major media. I mean, Clinton and Trump don't agree on anything, but they agree on big, bad China because it's been so long, so popular to make China out as an evil actor. This book, China Mirage, that's really what it's about. I mean, the domino theory, 4 million dead because of fear of China, the yellow peril. You know, up until 1882, we didn't exclude anybody from our shores. There were no illegal immigrants. And then the United States Congress decided that there's one race that's absolutely so terrible, we have to exclude them from our democracy. These were the Chinese. The only time we got along with China is when they had a Christian ruler, a Christian fascist ruler, who we called Southern Methodist Chang. You know, Mao reached out for 30 years to American presidents, to FDR, to Truman, to JFK. Finally, when Nixon picked up the invitation after 30 years, we credit him with reaching out to China. There would have been no Korean War if Harry Truman had responded to Mao. What if JFK had responded to Mao's peace feelers 2 years before he was killed? So it's China is the country we love to hate. The U.S. Navy's focusing it on a few rocks, and America's not getting the overall view that we are surrounding China with U.S. military might, and China doesn't like it.
Patrick Lawrence, it's very true what James Bradley was saying in terms of the orientation of Mao Zedong. The Chinese Communist Party led the revolution, a long, complicated revolution and armed struggle that lasted 27 years. At times, they had alliances against the Japanese with the nationalist forces, Chiang Kai-shek, who James was alluding to. At other times, they were in conflict and civil war. After World War II, when the UN was created, That seat, the United States made sure that one of the five seats in the Security Council that had veto power was for China, but that was the Chiang Kai-shek regime that lost power in 1949 when the Communist Party under the leadership of Mao took over. But when Mao spoke at the time in Tiananmen Square on October 1st, 1949, which China recognizes as the official day of the formation of the PRC, the People's Republic of China, he started by saying I thought it was very profound. He said, China has stood up, meaning China, the Chinese Revolution was reasserting China's role in the world, overcoming the humiliation by the West, not simply like a communist, even though it was the Communist Party, there was sort of a profoundly national element to his revolution. And yet the United States immediately, I mean, that's when the American witch hunt really went into full scale against even the leftists and socialists in the United States because of China. I mean, it had a profound impact on U.S. foreign policy.
For sure, for sure. The who lost China debate cost the careers of many, many highly qualified Sinologists, tragic stories. It's beyond objectionable. It's almost in the zone of just sadness how we cannot register events of any kind from the perspective of others. I had a conversation the other week on this, the question being empathy. I think our refusal to empathize, it's a way of it's a sort of hollow way of asserting our strength, as in we don't have to empathize with anybody and we don't have to understand how things look from another perspective, right? James will know this better than I. You walk around in China, the Opium Wars happened yesterday. They remember the 1830s and 40s better than you and I can remember, I don't know, Picket, Watergate or something, right?
And certainly better than the Alamo.
Yeah, fair comment. It transcends all questions of political stripe and ideology and all that. It's about what it means to be Chinese, right? I tip my cap to these people in this respect. Mao's phrase was something magnificent in that phrase, China stands up, you know, and this is part of the context. We would do very well to understand what these events mean from the Chinese side, and we wouldn't get so much wrong, I would venture to say, right?
Right. James Bradley, let's talk about that myopic orientation of the U.S., the inability, as Patrick said, to have empathy. In fact, any assertion by the Chinese to a greater standing in the world, either whether it's economic rise, which China has said from the beginning that it's a peaceful rise. They don't want wars. They haven't sought wars. They haven't been invading other countries. They did invade Vietnam in 1979 in a very short conflict, which had to do with other issues. But the United States government, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, wherever China seems to sort of assert itself, the American government immediately takes that as an act of aggression. I want to try to help the listeners understand what's beneath it, because empathy is an emotional term or a psychological term, and I agree with Patrick about it. But let's try to put the psychology of it into a political framework, because there seems to be a Washington consensus, regardless of whether it's the Republicans or Democrats, on these kind of questions.
The empathy is a tough one. I, like Patrick, I've lived in Asia. My son next week will go up to Central Vietnam and deliver some donations to a family whose father just got killed last year by an American bomb in his own field. More, you know, there's 58,000 Vietnam vets on the Vietnam Wall. Twice that many have died in Vietnam of unexploded ordnance since then.
Vietnamese people.
You know, when you look at the who's militarizing what, just go to Laos. One third of the country you still can't walk around. There's color-coded sidewalks. You know, don't walk off the sidewalk. Might be an American bomb still there. One third of the country, they still can't farm. So
that's amazing, because that was just for our audience who might be younger and even not that young. I mean, the United States left Laos in 1973, say, well, that's when the U.S. troops left South Vietnam. But here we are. That's more than 40 years ago. And you're saying that even today, like the dominance of unexploded U.S. ordnance bombs makes big parts of Laos uninhabitable. That's completely outside the U.S. psyche. And nobody knows that.
No, and nobody knows it. And that, and now in terms of China, if, like I say, every day the New York Times has an interactive feature on its website. You can look at these Chinese islands that they're building in unbelievable detail supplied by the United States military. But you've got to go outside the major media to see the 1,000 American bases ringing the globe. You can't see the 10 huge military bases that are choking, not choking, but circling China. I mean, you can't see reported that last year, 30,000 American troops with a few Australian troops did a exercise in the Straits of Malacca. That's like China and Mexico doing exercises in the Panama Canal. An Australian politician said, gee, I think most young people who join the Australian Defense Force, they think they're joining to defend Australia, not to join the Americans in attacking China.
Yeah. Patrick, the United States and the Philippines are citing the United Nations Conventions on the Law of the Sea to say that China's assertion of control over or the proclamation of sovereignty over disputed territories, islands, some of them are claimed by the Philippines, some are claimed by Vietnam, some are claimed by Japan. There's lots of disputes in this region about areas that are really off the mainland of any of these countries. But the United States cites the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. But is the United States a signer to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea?
Thank you very much. We are standing on international law now, okay? Remember, going back earlier in our conversation, the Philippines consented to bilateral talks and then suddenly filed a suit in The Hague, okay? I want to remind your readers that the Undersecretary for Asian Affairs later said, oh, gosh, I didn't know about that suit. It's a dead giveaway when a State Department official claims ignorance on a topic like this. When I heard that, I said to myself, he's either a liar or he should be fired, and the record argues for the former. The United States is a signatory to the UN Convention. It never ratified it, so it's not actually part of it. Suddenly, the United States is standing on international law. It's sheer opportunity. That's all there is to it. We, first of all, expanding the conversation a little bit, look around the world. We have no grounds whatsoever. We surrendered all claim long, long ago to any sort of prudence or rectitude in the matter of international law. We have nothing to stand on. I think the only people who are fooled by this are Americans. So in this case, the Americans have fastened on to it because however late they were to the party, they recognize this as a way to, I think the object of the exercise Monday is indeed not to make progress. It is, that's not even on the table in Washington or Manila. The object is to further embarrass China and further isolate China and recruit opposition, okay? That's what it's all about. It's indeed about the very thing it will accomplish, which is worsening the mess.
Well, the arbitration claim by, or the effort to bring in The Hague for arbitration was made by the Philippines. And as Patrick said, maybe under the pressure of the United States, at that time led the State Department, led by Hillary Clinton in 2012. But going back to the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas, which the United States is a signatory to but has not ratified, a group of Republican senators led by James Inhofe of Oklahoma blocked American ratification of the convention, claiming that it would impinge on U.S. sovereignty. In other words, once ratified by the U.S. Senate, it would become, according to the U.S. Constitution, the highest law of the land. The United States would have to live up to the obligations of an internationally signed treaty. So the United States says, you know what? We're not going to ratify it. We'll sign it. We'll cite it. We'll use it against China. But you can't use it against us because we're not going to ratify it because it impinges on our sovereignty. But China right now is asserting that the arbitration panel taking place, understanding or making a ruling on this case, is a fundamental violation of their sovereignty, and they want bilateral discussions instead of some court in The Hague deciding what's going to happen in the Pacific.
So often, Brian, one finds American arguments which are, to some startling degree, improvisational. So often one finds American arguments on diplomatic and political questions tumbling back upon us later on when they are precisely the opposite of convenient, right? I would like to, if I may, take a sec to make one other point, and it's this. I don't think we should be under any illusions that China has self-interest in mind here. Of course it does. The leadership in Beijing would not be responsible if they didn't think in these terms. But we have to put this against the principles, I think there were five, James will know, that Zhou Enlai defined in outlining China's intentions as to international conduct long, long ago, 40s or 50s. And one of them was non-intervention in the affairs of others. And I invite your listeners to think about that. You're quite right to cite the Vietnam case. But apart from that, China has a pretty good record of not intervening or aggressing upon other countries. I think that what we hear in America, and perhaps your European listeners hear the same or a variant, that the rest of the region is quaking over Chinese aggression and so forth, is vastly exaggerated for the sake of Western audiences. Are they concerned? Yes, of course they're concerned because they have self-interest too. That's the way, this is the nature of nation-state structures, right? That's just that. But look, the new president of the Philippines hasn't been in office a matter of weeks and has already said, I'd like to talk to the Chinese about
this. Let's leave it right there for now. That was Patrick Lawrence. He is the author of several books. We're also talking to James Bradley. He is the author of The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we are spending the full hour looking at how the dispute in the South China Sea affects the region and the world. We are joined by James Bradley. He's the author of the book, The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia. And by author Patrick Lawrence. His latest book is Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. James Bradley, Patrick was talking about the real orientation of the Philippines now that the Philippines has a new government. Of course, we know, as we discussed in the earlier segments, that the arbitration claim against China was initiated by a previous Philippine government, perhaps, as we said, under the pressure of Hillary Clinton's State Department in 2012. But the new Philippine government seems to have a new orientation. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, they have a new orientation, which is, you know, they want to talk it out with China, but that's the last thing the U.S. Navy wants. They want the China held in the glare of the so-called international law. And I want to go back to a statement that Patrick made, because I think it's really important. Only Americans are fooled by this international law argument. I mean, Obama's droning in eight countries there. Where's the international law there? Only Americans don't see the effects. The drone victims see it immediately. And we're using quote-unquote international law to argue about China. Look, China's rising. China needs to protect its periphery. China's 1.4 billion people. yeah, they're going to protect their coasts. And the reason that there's problems out there is because Hillary Clinton said this is a spot of the world that will militarize. And President Obama said, we're going to pivot our some very lethal assets over there to try to deal with China militarily. It's a wrong approach. We could save an awful lot of money and let China's peaceful rise come. You know, I was in a briefing with a top admiral who advises the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they had unbelievable satellite photography, scary stuff, you know, what China's doing, making it feel like those islands are right next to California or something. And at the end of the presentation, I said, what's the problem here? Let's say China builds all this. They're going to shut the straits. Ford Motor Company is never going to get another car through those straits. And he gave a convoluted answer, something about China's not stable enough and they could have ethnic divisions and lose control of this and that. And people were stunned that the U.S. Navy didn't have a direct question to the, you know, what are all these bad things that are going to happen? The reason is because they're never asked. We're just being scaremongered as we were with the domino theory, as we were with the yellow peril. It's very politically potent to blame China for just about anything you want. This is a long strain in American history, which I documented in my last book, and it's scary how it's being used emotionally to move the American public against China for no reason.
Patrick Lawrence, let me pick up on what James said, but outline a slightly different scenario in terms of U.S. geostrategic calculations to the extent that they're valid at all. But they might be just, of course, seeking a pretext, as the admiral's comments seem to be, in terms of why the U.S. was doing this. But let's go back to the 1980s, because the Soviet Union at that time, which was a multinational country, it had 15 different republics, many autonomous areas, clearly a multinational federation or union. At that time in the 1980s, the U.S. oriented a Soviet pivot. There was a big, big military buildup. Reagan put a lot of pressure on the Soviets. They put missiles all around the Soviet Union and Europe, in Western Europe, with a flight time of 6 minutes to Soviet targets. There was such a huge expenditure on the military side by the United States that the Soviets sort of did the same thing on the sort of the paradigm of military parity, but it took a much bigger chunk out of the Soviet economy because it was a smaller economy. And at the same time, the United States intelligence agencies and its military were working ceaselessly, as they had been since the end of World War II and perhaps before, looking for weaknesses and vulnerabilities within the Soviet Union. Finally, the multi-ethnic nature of the Soviet Union became a point of vulnerability. And as we know, when the Soviet Union and its government was finally overthrown by people who obviously had a pro-American orientation, certainly those with Yeltsin and those within the Politburo and within the Soviet media at the time, the Soviet Union broke apart. So this huge country was no longer. And instead of it being 15 republics united, you had independent Ukraine, you had the Baltics, of course, the Caucasus, the Asian countries. In other words, the breakup of the Soviet Union, which seemed impossible to predict 10 years or 5 years or even a few years earlier, happened. Is it possible that the U.S. calculations are that if the Chinese government were to be, if it was, quote, unstable and it could be overthrown, that the same sort of breakup of China could happen? And it, could that be part of the calculations?
Implicit in your question is it sounds a bit far-fetched. I'm with you there. It does. However, and I think it is far-fetched, but a couple of things. One, the United States and many Americans, and indeed a lot of historians, have it very wrong about the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, which were two different events. Events of that magnitude, okay, do not occur by, generally speaking, I hope I'm not putting down a rule of history that can be countered. Internal causes in the Soviet Union, the better histories will take you back to the 30s to identify the roots of the problems that resulted in the demise of the Soviet Union. Reagan has been awarded far too much sort of ahistorical credit for what happened. That's one. Two, going to your question more directly, you can't really tell, realistically, you cannot really tell where planning, I wouldn't say state, I would say in the national security apparatus in the Pentagon, actually ends. I mean, they, if you look back into history, they have had some pretty far-fetched plans or possibles, right? So you don't really know. Are they counting on China breaking up? They might be. I can't answer that question with any confidence or authority whatsoever.
Let me reframe it, because I want to make it clear for you guys and also for our listeners. I'm not saying there's a plan A, let's break up China, and this is how we're going to go about it. Of course, China, like the Soviet Union, like all countries, has weaknesses. It has vulnerabilities. It has sort of fault lines around which divisions can take place. And it's more true for emerging countries than those countries that have been sort of stably existing and ruling the roost for a couple hundred years. In other words, the countries of Western Europe and the United States, whose social system and political system is more entrenched, more stable. But what I'm suggesting is, should there be a major sort of division, a political division within China, say over the question of how to deal with the military threat from the United States, maybe over whether to maintain or not the historic relations with North Korea. In other words, some people might say in the Chinese establishment, it's not worth it. Let's appease the United States and stop handling China. In other words, there were elements within the Soviet establishment said, well, look, if we just got rid of East Europe, that, you know, we'll have peace at last with the United States. We'll appease them. But in fact, that set in motion a chain of events that was beyond anyone's control. And certainly not even in Washington, even if they crow about it and take credit for it, they weren't anticipating it. Nobody could have really done that. But James Bradley, what I'm suggesting is, and what I'm asking is there enough vulnerability in China? We saw in Tiananmen Square, for instance, where there was nearly, and that was at the same time of the breakup of the East European countries. In other words, the possibility within U.S. geostrategic calculations where China's political leadership could be tested in a major way.
I don't think so. But I, as I documented in my last book, it's within Washington, they repeatedly, since 1949, talk about how the government's going to fall and the internal weaknesses. And I got told by a top military person in Washington, D.C. 3 weeks ago, President Xi is going to fall. Well, the Secretary of State in the 1950s would go to all these Asian capitals talking about how Mao was going to fall. And Prince Norodom Sihanouk of Cambodia wrote an article and said, what are these Americans drinking? You know, the Chinese standard of life has gone up. Mao's popular in China. I mean, and the comparison to the Soviet Union's a brand new invention. The United States of America is a brand new invention. We're talking about China. China being ruled from Beijing, 5,000-6,000-year-old China.
But China was severely divided during that century of humiliation. In other words, the Western powers had their own zones. In other words, you're right. It's a 6,000-year-old. Go ahead.
Okay, but let's talk about a tiny aberration, very long history, and the British and the Americans and the French and the Germans get the opium and wrest control of territory. You're talking about the invasion of China, and it was a small period, but that's not going to happen again. And that's part of why China is so emotional about its perimeter. It was invaded by Western countries, and there was disorder. The Chinese want order. The order comes from the emperor in Beijing. The emperor now is a panel instead of just one person. But I'd argue that the comparisons with the breakup of the brand new Soviet Union don't apply to age-old China.
Patrick Lawrence, I don't want to belabor it too much, but because I agree with James, although what happened to China certainly is a part of the Chinese Communist Party's leadership's thinking. They were aware of it. They were alarmed by it. All of the governments that had been at one time sister socialist republics with the USSR were deeply concerned about it. And they also recognized that there are those within China who have been sort of courted by the West. So in terms of China's calculations, and going back again, not that it will happen, I'm not being predictive or suggestive in any way, in any possible way, but in terms of China's thinking, China's own views and calculations, especially when it comes up to what we're talking about with the arbitration hearing in The Hague and the issue of America militarizing its presence all over the Asia Pacific. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, you know, I think this question of Chinese unity and stability, I think it's rooted in domestic concerns, not, at least at this point in history, international concerns. Okay, there's an old phrase in Chinese, James will know it, heaven is high and the emperor is far away. It means the central government is a long way away and we need not pay too much attention to it. Okay, it's a huge country. It's far more multi-ethnic than it would like to think, indeed, than most of us think. And unity has always been a sort of subtext among Chinese leaders. There's no question of that. It goes back to the earliest emperors and their insistence that every road in China is the same width and all that. Stitching the nation together and keeping it that way is inherently a problem on the mainland, never mind anything else. And I think that right now, at this period in history, I'm with James. I don't think that these international questions will have anything to do with the future of Chinese stability. No. I think in my walking around in China, last time I suppose was maybe 5 or 6 years ago for an extended period, I think China is in for a political transition. Whether it is orderly or chaotic is really up to the leadership. In my read, it's probably got, and I drew this read from people, Chinese I interviewed and respected. Some of them became friends. It's probably got 20 or 30 years before it evolves, one would like to think, into some form of social democracy. They talk about the Nordic model or the Second International versus the Third and all that sort of thing. That's hard to say, other than drawing up a wish list. But I think these questions are internal. The dynamic, the political dynamic in China is internal. It's going to be determined by pressures on the central government and the central government's response to challenge.
Okay, James Bradley, in our last few minutes, I want you to jump in right back into the same discussion because I think it is critically important to the calculations. So both of you are saying that the problems in China, to the extent that they have problems, and of course all countries do, the prospects of instability come from within. What's happening on the international front maybe isn't dominant, certainly isn't decisive. But as we could see in the Tiananmen Square protests in June 1989 and May, the American media was all over that. They were certainly, they had taken sides and they were hoping as they had been in the Eastern Europe, that the protesters would somehow succeed in bringing down the government. Until that time and after that time, there wasn't talk in American media or in the American government about that as a priority. But I still believe that the Chinese government is certainly aware that should there be internal turmoil based on anything, whether it's an economic recession, a crisis on the borders, or whatever the problems are, that the United States would enter the fray somehow, not directly perhaps, but certainly as a major global force in promoting those forces that the Chinese government thought were trying to take advantage and overthrow the Chinese government. And I believe that the Chinese government still holds that as a premise. And even though they have not challenged the United States in the Middle East and its hegemony or in Latin America or other places, certainly when it comes to the Pacific and all of this military pressure, it's not just about what's going to happen in the islands. It's going to be what happens everywhere, including what happens inside of China. But go ahead, James Bradley.
You know, I'm not trying to sell a book, but I just want to say the title. I wrote a book called The China Mirage. And the reason I put the word mirage in there is because there's these recurring themes. the domino theory. I mean, you just hear it in the press right now. You know, if the United States Navy's not out there, China's going to grab these straits and plunder these countries and invade here. And another recurring theme is, how's China going to change? Most of the U.S. coverage of China for the last 200 years has been in expectation of their change. That's why we got so excited with Chiang Kai-shek. He was a Christian. We were going to have Christian trickle-down Christianity from Chiang Kai-shek and his family, and they were going to become a new China. Fortune used to write articles about new China. Time magazine would write about new China. And in new China, it looked like America, and they adopted American democratic ideals. But no, there's China, and Beijing's going to do things their way. I see China as much more stable. I don't buy into these themes that China is an aggressor that we have to worry about. I don't buy into the theme that, you know, we Westerners should speculate about how China is going to change and that we'll get it right.
We're going to have to leave it there. It's been an excellent discussion. We've been talking about the South China Sea dispute, the arbitration at The Hague, but even more importantly about the bigger framework of China's role in history, China's role in the Pacific, and of course, U.S.-China relations. We were joined by James Bradley. He's the author of the book, The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia, and by author Patrick Lawrence. His latest book is Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. We'll be back tomorrow. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.